You might be wondering how and why I decided a couple weeks back to shift from studying the Gospel according to Matthew to studying the last section of the book of Genesis, the first book of the Bible. And I have not explained myself in much detail. I had some reasons, some burdens for doing so. But here we are, the third study in the life of Joseph, and I now want to explain my reasons. First one's really simple. One of the things we try to do is we always try to balance Old Testament and New Testament teaching. The second reason is because the truth that's contained in these chapters, Genesis 37 to 50, the truth that's contained here is the bedrock foundation of trusting God. If you want to trust God and trust God more through trials, understanding this truth, God's providence, that God is in control of every detail of life, is the bedrock foundation of that trust. The third reason that I'm focused on this, it challenges us, especially teenagers, to not be deists. Recent studies have shown, studies especially done by a man named Christian Smith, studies have shown that most teenagers who are raised in gospel-preaching churches grow up to believe these two things about God. First, quote, "There is a God who exists, who created and ordered the world and watches over human life." Second, that God does not need to be particularly involved in anyone's life except when he's needed to resolve a problem. That is the way statistics show that most teenagers who grow up in church think about God. He exists, there's one God who exists, and he's really not needed except when resolving a problem. And I want to use this series to challenge young people, teenagers in particular, to trust the God of the Bible. Sometimes people have this idea in our area and in our country, I believe in God, I'm okay. Faith in God, just generic God, I believe in God, it's not enough. It's not enough. We need to believe in the God of the Bible. One famous historic Christian confession puts it like this: we need to believe that God so preserves me that without the will of my Father in heaven, not a hair can even fall from my head. His control, his oversight of my life is that specific, that detailed. The Bible reveals this kind of personal controlling God. We don't just believe in God, we believe in a God who is in complete control over every detail of life. Fourth and finally, I think it's crucial to use the calm to prepare for the storm. Romans 8:28, God works all things together for good, is an absolutely crucial verse to believe. But it's probably not the most effective verse to tell people right when they're in the middle of a trial. What Job's friends needed to do, what Job needed from his friends, was just silence. Just be with me. Just empathize with my pain. At that point, Job didn't need people to try to explain what was going on. The time that we need to prepare for trials is when we are, relatively speaking, going through a time of peace. You prepare best for war when the enemy is not attacking. You may need to rush preparations while the enemy is attacking, don't get me wrong. But the best time to prepare for war is during peace. And you actually prepare with the hopes that you'll never need to use all the preparations. I sense that just right now, we have a relative experience of peace in the congregation, and it is crucial time for us to arm ourselves with the truth that we will need if our enemy strikes and when our enemy strikes in days ahead. This is now the third time that we're studying Genesis. If you want the book of Genesis in a nutshell, so we're jumping, today we're in chapter 40, so if you've not read the first 40 chapters recently, let me tell you what basically happens. God creates the world, and he creates the world good. He speaks his word and brings order out of chaos. He shows that his word has the power to bring order out of chaos. And then what happens immediately after God creates the world is Adam and Eve, the first humans, his first creatures, human creatures who have the will to choose whether to love him and trust him and obey him or not, they choose to rebel against him. It is anarchy. They rebel against their creator and plunge the entire creation along with all the rest of humanity who would come from them in ruin. Creation and humanity are not what we were created to be. We were created to be good. And ever since our first ancestors, Adam and Eve, all of creation has been broken and humanity has had a spirit of rebellion. You move just a little bit farther in Genesis like chapters 6 through 9, and we find that the sinfulness, the rebellion, the disobedience of man toward Creator, toward our Creator God, is so great that God says, here's one way I could deal with the problem. I could just wipe people off the face of the earth. And he wipes almost all people off the face of the earth except for one family, Noah, because God showed grace to Noah. And if you think, oh, God did that because Noah was such a good guy, just read the story of Noah. He's infected with the problem of rebelliousness just like everyone else. God is simply saying, this is one way that I could deal with humanity. I could wipe them off the face of the earth. And that's the black backdrop against which the cross of Jesus, the if you will, option two, it was always God's plan, but set against the flood, it's option two. I can save people who will put their trust in the Messiah King. God separates people at Babel into different languages and different territories on earth. God does that to delay man's own self-destruction. And immediately the next chapter says, I'm going to pick one of these families and I'm going to work in this family, Abraham's family, to bring blessing to all the families that I just split up on earth. Again, if you think God's choosing Abraham because Abraham's such a good guy, you've not read the scriptures. Joshua says that Abraham was an idolater. And if you look at the history of his family, yep, they're superstitious idolaters out of Ur of the Chaldees. And you can actually see famous idol temples at Ur where Abraham came out of still today. Archaeologists have uncovered them. Abraham was an idolater, but God says, I'm going to work in your family and in your descendants, all the people of the earth are going to be blessed. So God starts working in Abraham. And as we see God's grace unfold for Abraham, he is faithful to his promises. As we see it unfold, we start coming to realize that Abraham's family is a wreck. Abraham doesn't have faith like he should. And he has a couple monumental failures in his life that God is faithful to him during. Abraham's son, Isaac, he is playing favorites with his boys. There's dissension between him and his wife. Isaac's son Jacob is even worse, a deceiver who ends up having 12 sons by four different moms. The family is a mess, and yet God's made a promise to them. And what happens throughout Genesis is exactly what happened in chapter 1. In chapter 1, God spoke the world into existence. It was a chaotic mess. And then every day he said, let there be light, and let there be plants, and let there be people. And he called order out of chaos. He's doing it on planet Earth, and he's even doing it in this one family, Abraham's family. He has made a promise by his word to Abraham. And that word is going to bring order out of chaos, first to the family, and then to the world. He's going to call order out of chaos. Jacob's 12 sons are a wreck. They are murderers. They're kidnappers. They're deceivers. They're immoral. They're disobedient. This describes Jacob's 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel. They're a chaotic mess. In Genesis 37, they sell the brothers, 11 of the brothers, or 10 of the brothers, sell Joseph into slavery. They commit the sin of human trafficking against their brother. Joseph goes into slavery in Egypt. And we found out last week in chapter 39 that after 10 years at least 10 years of faithfully serving in the house of the captain of the guard, the captain of the guard's wife accuses Joseph unjustly, falsely. She accuses him of attempted rape, and Joseph is sentenced to prison. I think that's an indication that the captain of the guard did not believe his wife, because you don't treat Hebrew slaves who are accused of attempted rape with imprisonment. And we'll see today even that Potiphar is the one who's over the prison and he's putting Joseph in charge. It looks like this was just a way of getting Joseph and Potiphar's wife to separate in a way that satisfied the wife and didn't completely get rid of Joseph. It was almost like just a change of position for Potiphar, putting this well-trusted man in another place of service. But Joseph is wronged and he is imprisoned. One Old Testament introduction puts Joseph's story like this. They say, from a human perspective, it appears that Joseph falls prey to ill luck as he moves from Palestine to Egypt, from Potiphar's house to prison. Indeed, his life seems to be determined by those who seek to harm him. Joseph, however, is aware that God is the one behind the events, that God overrules the wicked intentions of men and women in order to save his people, runs throughout the Old Testament, but perhaps nowhere as explicitly, as clearly as this story of Joseph's life. I've entitled the series, No Such Thing as Luck. Luck is success or failure that just happens by chance. That doesn't exist. Don't wish people good luck. Good luck doesn't exist. Don't say, well, I guess I fell into bad luck. Bad luck doesn't exist. There's no such thing as chance if God is in control of every detail of life. Genesis 40 is where we pick up, reading in verse 1. We are actually going to spend a good portion of time today reading through these two chapters. I'm going to skip over a few portions, but let's engage our minds, and then I'm going to go after the main point with four applications. That's where we're going today. Genesis 40, verse 1. Sometime after this, that's after Joseph was wrongfully accused of the attempted rape, sometime after this, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker committed an offense against their lord, the king of Egypt, that's Pharaoh. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and he put them in custody of the house of the captain of the guard in the prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with them, so Joseph was their personal attendant in prison, and they continued for some time in custody. If you look back at chapter 37, verse 36, and at chapter 39, verse 1, the captain of the guard that's referred to here at the beginning of chapter 40 is Potiphar. That means Potiphar, when his wife accused Joseph of attempted rape, Potiphar put Joseph into another realm of this secret service agency, if you will, where Joseph could have management, but was away from the wife. It indicates that Potiphar probably did not believe his wife's accusation. Verse 5. One night, both of these men dreamed, the cupbearer and the baker. Each dreamed his own dream, each dream with its own interpretation. Verse 6. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, "Why are your faces downcast?" They said to him, "We've had dreams and there's no one to interpret them." Joseph said, "Don't interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph. And I'm going to summarize the dreams just to save a little bit of time. The cupbearer, one of Pharaoh's closest and most trusted household assistants, personal assistants, dreams about a vine that has three branches coming off of it. Those three branches grew grapes, And the cupbearer takes the grapes off of the branches and presses them into Pharaoh's cup. And Joseph says, this is what your dream means. The three branches are 3 days. Verse 13, in 3 days, Pharaoh will restore you to your position. In other words, you will serve again as his cupbearer. Joseph says, when that happens, verse 14, only remember me when it's well with you. And please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh and to get me out of this house. I indeed was stolen out of the land of the Hebrews. And here also, I've done nothing that they should put me into the pit. Appeal my case to Pharaoh. You're in a position of influence. Please remember me. Verse 16, when the chief baker saw that the interpretation was favorable, he told Joseph his dream about how 3 baskets of bread were on his head and the birds were eating out of it. And Joseph explains it. The 3 baskets symbolize 3 days. And in 3 days, Pharaoh is going to execute you. The text says, verses 21 and 22, that everything happened as Joseph said. The cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph, but completely forgot about him. Chapter 41, after 2 whole years, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing by the Nile. And behold, there came up out of the Nile 7 cows, fat cows, and they fed in the reed grass. Behold, 7 other cows, ugly and thin, came up out of the Nile after them and stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile. And the ugly, thin cows ate up the 7 attractive plump cows, and Pharaoh awoke. He then fell asleep, and he dreamed basically the same thing, only this time, instead of 7 cows, it was 7 lobes of grain that were coming off a big stalk. And the dreams really bothered Pharaoh. Verse 8 says, he sent for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them to Pharaoh. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, I remember my sins today. He remembers how he didn't keep his word. When Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me and the chief baker into custody in the house of the captain of the guard, we dreamed on the same night. A young Hebrew was there with us. We told him, he interpreted our dreams, giving an interpretation to each man according to his dream. Verse 13, as he interpreted it to us, that's exactly how it happened. I was restored to my position, but the baker was impaled. Verse 14, the Pharaoh sent and called Joseph. They quickly brought him up out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh. I'm going to pick up reading in verse 25 because Pharaoh is going to explain the dream again. But let me just talk about this one detail about Joseph shaving himself. Basically, it means that if you're in here and you're a man and you prefer to be clean shaven, you're not as godly as those people who prefer to be scruffy. You can laugh. The Hebrews were scruffy. And the Egyptians were not. And it has nothing to do with godliness. It has to do with culture. This detail about Joseph shaving is really significant for establishing the historicity, the historical accuracy of this account. These kinds of details are accurate, showing that the person who's telling the story must have had, at least within 200 years of the events of the story, must have had an idea of what Egyptian culture was like in specifics. I share that with you because some of you in here may be saying, you may have gone to college and the teacher takes the classic view that these are just myths. People came up with these 1,000 years later to make sense of Israelite history and identity and things like this. It doesn't fly. These accounts have the mark of historical accuracy. And you might be reading on Wikipedia and take one of these statements that says, there's nothing in the account that gives an idea that this would be written any closer than about 1,000 years away from the history. It's just not true. When people try to marshal, this is what all scholars believe, or this is what all academics believe, or no one believes that anymore. Challenge it. Take some time to evaluate what people are saying. And one of the things that you come to realize is simply from the fact that Joseph shaved himself, there is a cultural detail that indicates the historical accuracy of this account. Anyway, Joseph comes to Pharaoh. It seems that this Pharaoh is Senusret III. He becomes the most powerful Pharaoh in the Middle Kingdom, probably through Joseph's policies of buying the Egyptians' land from them. This is the most powerful Pharaoh in the Middle Kingdom, and he explains his dream to Joseph. Verse 26, the seven good cows are 7 good years. The 7 good years are 7 years. They mean the same thing, verse 27. The 7 lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years. The 7 empty ears blighted by the east wind are also 7 years of famine. It is as I told Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. There will come 7 years of great plenty throughout the whole land of Egypt. Then after them, there will be 7 years of famine. And all the plenty of those 7 previous years will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of the famine that will follow, for it will be severe. The fact that the dreams have been doubled means that the thing is fixed by God. God will shortly bring it about. In other words, God knows and controls the future. Then Joseph does something very risky. He gives Pharaoh management advice. Now therefore, Pharaoh, here's what you should do. Select a discerning wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh then proceed to appoint overseers over the land, over various districts, taking 1/5 of the produce of the land during the plentiful years. This is a 20% tax. Let them gather all the food these good years that are coming and store up grain according to the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities. Let them keep it. That food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish during those 7 years of famine. This proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, there's no one so discerning and wise as you. You will be over my house and over all my people. All my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you." So Pharaoh promotes Joseph. In the Middle East, this would be called the vizier. Pharaoh promotes Joseph to second in the kingdom. He gave him an Egyptian name in verse 45. His name means God speaks and lives. He gave him a wife from the Egyptian aristocracy. Verse 46 says Joseph was 30 years old when all this happened. And then for the next 7 years, he served well. Jump down to verse 50. Before the famine came, so Joseph is not yet 37, 2 sons were born to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, "God has made me forget," that's the key word, "forget all my hardship and all my father's house." Nasa means to make someone forget. The name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Farah means to make fruitful. And the two names show that within just a few years after Joseph's exaltation, all of his hardships were a thing of the past. Let me simply point out that even though Joseph is raised to Egyptian nobility, he does not become an Egyptian. He raises his boys according to the Hebrew faith. There's no indication whether his wife retained her Egyptian faith or whether she converted to the Hebrew faith. There are legends that say she converted to the Hebrew faith. But clearly, Joseph raised his boys Hebrew in an Egyptian culture, and he becomes a powerful example of being in the world, but not of it. The basic point in this message that God wants us to get is that God knows the future completely. He controls the future completely. And he reveals the future in bits and pieces as he sees fit. That's what's going on. The main point of Genesis 40 and 41, God completely knows the future. He completely controls the future. And he reveals the future in bits and pieces as he sees fit. Do you know that God knows the future? If someone came up to you, which is something that's very common now among professing Christians today, they'll say, God does not know the future, and they actually think they're solving the problem of evil. God doesn't know the future. They say, he responds to the future like we do, only with much greater wisdom, with omniscient kind of wisdom. He has an understanding of what's taken place throughout history in every culture so that when God responds to what happens in the future, he does so with much greater wisdom. But God can't know the future, many professing Christians say, because the future doesn't even exist. How can you know something that doesn't exist? What would you say to someone? Can you articulate your faith that God knows the future? Can you prove it? Let me just stop right here and say, if you cannot, take some time this week and study the scriptures for yourself until you can explain in your own words, from your own memory, the answer to this question. Does God know the future? Let me give you a couple tips. If someone challenges you like that, take them to Genesis 40 and 41. Because in this passage, God knows the future of individuals like the cupbearer and the baker. He knows the future decision of kings, like what Pharaoh is going to decide on his birthday. He knows the future of the weather and how there's going to be famine. And he knows the future of the rise and fall of nations, that Egypt, through this famine, is going to become a great nation internationally. God knows the future of individuals, kings, nature, and nations. And this passage proves it. One of my favorite passages is Psalm 139, verse 16. 900 years after Joseph, in this psalm, David confesses, "You, God, saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed." That's a quote of the Bible. Every single moment was laid out in God's day planner for my life before a single day of my life had passed. That is personal conviction that God knows my future personally. Third passage that I would point people to is Isaiah 46, especially verse 10. God says, "I declare the end from the beginning." In other words, I declare the end of history before the first day of creation begins. And God says in this passage, that's what makes me God. And then the last passage I would point people to, and this is how you can take a conversation like this right to the cross, is I would say, look at Acts chapter 2, or you could go to Acts chapter 4. This is where the apostles are persecuted for their faith in Jerusalem. And in chapter 4, they pray to the Lord, saying, "Truly, in this very city, Lord, there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed. There were gathered together Herod, Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the Jews, and they did whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place." The cross was at one and the same time the most wicked moment of human history, when we crucified the Son of God, and it was in perfect keeping with the plan of God before he ever started one day of creation. These kinds of examples throughout Scripture help to prove our conviction that God completely knows the future. He completely controls the future. And he reveals it in bits and pieces. He reveals it through bits and pieces. Let me just ask, what do you make of all these dreams? Is that really weird to you? What do you make of the dreams? God gave Joseph two dreams. He gives the cupbearer and a baker a pair of dreams. He gives Pharaoh two dreams. God is speaking in dreams. Does God still speak in dreams today? Maybe more personally, does God speak in your dreams today? What do you make of this? There's a very simple answer, and just before we get to the application, I want to address this because it's a major issue of how we apply the passage. Does God still speak through dreams? Major passage helps us answer the question. This is Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Quote, "Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers through the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son." And he goes on and he says, "This Son is the appointed heir of all creation. This Son is the one through whom he created the world." He says, "This Son is the very radiance of God's glory," meaning he is God in human form. "This Son upholds the universe, all of nature. He upholds it second by second by his powerful word." And he says of the Son that this Son is the one who made purification for sins. That is, he died on the cross so that sinners could be forgiven. And then he was raised up and he is now seated at the right hand of God. He is enthroned over the universe waiting to return. That's what this passage says. And it starts off saying, before Jesus came, God spoke in all kinds of ways to various people. Can you think of various methods in which God spoke? He spoke with an angel out of a burning bush to Moses. Abraham was met by three angelic visitors. Joseph and a couple people that Joseph knows have dreams. Balaam gets the word of God from a donkey, to name just a few. God spoke in many different ways his word of prophecy to his people. That's what this word says. But in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son. In other words, we should not expect God to speak in the ways he did before Christ, after Christ. Because the point of the verse is Christ is the very peak of the mountain. God has spoken most clearly and most fully in the coming of Jesus Christ. And as soon as the apostles who knew Jesus explain what he was like, why is there need for further revelation? The biggest, fullest, clearest revelation has already come. So just before I jump into our applications, let me ask, have you personally trusted Jesus, the one who made purification for your sins? Have you personally turned away from your rebellion against God, said, "God, forgive me, I'm sorry"? Have you personally committed your life to King Jesus, to the one who sits enthroned over the universe, waiting for the time to return? On the day that the creator and sustainer of the universe returns, will he recognize you as one of his followers? Have you trusted him, entrusted your life to him, committed your life to him? The point of all of this revelation that came before Jesus is, give your life to Jesus. The point of the dreams is not, what did that dream that I just woke up with mean? Is that going to happen? No, don't think about your dreams like that. God used to speak to people in different ways, different means, and dreams was one of them. He's now spoken to us in his Son. Have you responded to the authority and the love of Jesus over you and for you? Have you personally responded to Jesus? Are you a personal, committed follower of Jesus? That's what you should think when you think, those dreams are kind of weird. Yeah, they are kind of weird. That was the way God spoke until he spoke to us in Jesus. What have you done with Jesus? As I wrap up, I suggest four ways that these chapters should shape our lives. How does your conviction that God knows, controls, and reveals the future, how does that make a difference in daily life? The first way it makes a difference is we need to live with, I'll call it, tough trust in God. Joseph knew that God knew, controlled, and partially revealed the future. Joseph knew this. That did not make his life easy. It was hard. He was falsely accused, imprisoned. For 2 whole years, the first words of chapter 41, he was forgot about by a political elite who had promised to help him. For Joseph, belief that God was in control of the future actually meant that it was harder to trust God, because he had to believe that God was in control of the bad things happening to him. That is really, really hard to believe. Belief that God is in complete control of every detail of your life is not always comforting. It is sometimes disturbing, terrifying, even dreadful. Ask Jerry Sitzer. I've quoted from his book, A Grace Disguised, before. Jerry Sitzer's daughter, wife, and mother were killed in an instant when a drunk driver crossed the middle line on the road and plowed headfirst into their minivan one night when they were sharing the gospel on an Indian reservation. Sitzer writes, "I avoided even thinking about God's sovereignty after the accident. The very idea that the God whom I had tried for so many years to trust and follow would allow or even cause such a tragedy was unthinkable to me. But over time," he says, "I realized that the trajectory of my grief had set me on a collision course with God." He says, "I knew I either had to make peace with God's sovereignty, I had to reject God altogether, or I had to settle for a lesser God who either lacked the desire to prevent the accident or lacked the power to prevent the accident." Trust in God, and I say this as an intentional pun, puts you between the rock and a hard place. Trust in God is not easy for people who know that he controls the future. It puts you between your pain and God. And that's not easy. It's tough. Joseph lived there. The Bible teaches us that if we are convinced that God knows and controls the future, we are going to have to live in this place of tough trust. Second, we have to live with concern for others. Concern for others. I get this especially from chapter 40, verses 6 and 7. Joseph's example is just staggering. He is caring for people in jail, and he notices their despair, that their faces are downcast, and he does something to help them. He takes time and tries to comfort them. This is not our common experience, is it, when we're going through times of suffering? What's your knee-jerk reaction when you're going through trials? I'll tell you what my knee-jerk reaction is. My knee-jerk reaction is to become irritable and to become focused on myself and to expect others to be extremely patient with me as I'm going through such a hard time. Now is your opportunity to serve me, not my opportunity to serve you. That's how I naturally react when I'm going through hard times. When you live with confidence that God knows and controls the future, it has the power to free you from self-focus. God is in control of the future. He is bringing me through this time of suffering. And that allows us to focus on God as the point of life, not our comfort. Joseph's concern for these two men, his unselfish concern, led him to explain what he knew of the future. And this is a powerful encouragement to our evangelism. You don't know anybody's future immediately. You don't know whether they're going to live today or tomorrow. You don't know whether business is going to go good or bad. But you do know one thing about people's future. And you know that for people like the cupbearer, there will be exaltation. Who are those people? It's people who put their trust in Jesus. I'm not saying the cupbearer trusted in Jesus. I'm just trying to say this is how you apply the passage. Joseph knew the future of the cupbearer, and he knew the future of the baker, and he loved them and shared it with them in all honesty. You know something about the future of people. And that is, if you trust Jesus, no matter how hard life gets now, there is coming a day of glory for you when you're going to see the King in all his beauty. You're going to be exalted to life in the kingdom. And it is going to go well with you. If you trust Jesus, there will be exaltation after suffering. And you can also look at people and with loving concern for them, you can say, if you continue to reject Jesus, if you continue to say no to Jesus, if you continue to not believe in Jesus or not figure out what the Bible says about Jesus so you could even get to first base and evaluate what the Bible says about him, if you keep on rejecting Jesus, there will be something much worse than what the baker experienced in terms of fury at Pharaoh's hand. There will be eternal condemnation under the wrath of God. You, in loving concern, can have your eyes open to the needs of other people, and you can share with them that their future is absolutely certain, contingent on how they respond to King Jesus. I think we should learn this from the passage. Third, we must live with wisdom. Joseph lets what he knows about the future affect how he lives in the present. In a time of prosperity, then, he saves rather than spends. He knows that famine is coming, and he does whatever he can to keep the people around him, the community around him, the nations around him, from experiencing starvation. Now, we could look at this in nearsighted and then farsighted ways. If you're looking at it just up close for the next couple of years, we could learn from this financial wisdom, political wisdom, financially speaking. If you're having a good year, save. Some of you are learning how to in financial peace. It's always good to save. When God gives you more, save more. Joseph teaches us a basic lesson like this. Politically speaking, Joseph models for us ways that we can bless our neighbors by encouraging healthy food policies. We can encourage our governments to be involved in, and other groups to be involved in famine relief. This is a good thing. We should be particularly careful about governments, and I'm talking whether you are red or blue, about spending more than comes in. The more and more our states and our nation increase debt, we are condemning the next generation. America is the wealthiest nation on planet Earth, and we are not good at saving. In fact, we can't save. Looking at just the next couple of years, these are some basic principles for finances, for politics. But this passage pertains to a whole lot more. What God has revealed to us has to do with the return of Jesus. And it compels us to ask, are we saving up treasure in heaven? Are we storing up our goods that God's given us for the future that God has revealed to us? It compels us to ask, am I setting aside significant portions of my annual income to help our local community and peoples internationally be rescued from the ultimate famine? What is the ultimate famine? But being starved of God's goodness and God's presence forever. And we should be storing up our resources for people locally to hear how they can be saved from that famine, and people internationally how they can be saved from that famine. The last point is we must live with the confidence that our trials will end. and I get this from the name of Joseph's first son. Joseph Lee just he just patiently trusted what God had revealed about the future. That was not easy, but he kept trusting. And when that wonderful future that God had revealed to him became a reality, Joseph names his first son Forgotten. Don't forget that, believers at Tri-County. Joseph's first son is named Forgotten. Within a few years of Joseph's exaltation, the 13 plus years of hardship were forgotten. That doesn't mean he never remembered them. It means that the blessings of today had so outweighed the sufferings of the past, they seem like a light thing to Joseph. The past was the past. There's coming a time, Christian, when after you experience resurrected life in a glorified, immortal body, all these decades of trials are going to seem like a distant memory. By comparison of what you experienced then in the kingdom, everything that you've gone through now is going to seem light and momentary. It is not easy to live with this conviction that God knows, controls, and reveals the future. But it should lead you to a daily confidence that one day your trials are going to be passed.